Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. Thanks for spending some time with me this Friday. The theme of today's show is the 2019 Emmy Awards, which will take place on Sunday, September 22nd in Los Angeles. We've been fortunate enough to have many of the nominees on this show, including some of the actors and showrunners from longtime favorites ending their run, like Veep and House of Cards, to new critically acclaimed shows like Russian Doll and Dead to Me. But let's start the show with the creative team behind The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel from Amazon. All the show's leads are nominated for Emmys. Rachel Brosnahan for Best Actress, Maren Hinkle and Alex Borstein both for Best Supporting Actress, and Tony Shalhoub for Best Supporting Actor, and the series for Best Comedy Series. Earlier this year, we spoke with the creators of the New York-centric The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, husband and wife team Dan Palladino and Amy Sherman Palladino. How do you describe Midge, Amy?
You know, Midge is a supremely confident lady. She was always queen of her six blocks and kind of loved her life and always felt like her life was perfect and she scored and she got it. And then when it fell apart, it revealed a whole other set of skills and thought process that she never knew was there in the first place. And the thing that we wanted to really make sure that she wasn't a woman who was dissatisfied from the very beginning, staring out the window, having her sherry at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, thinking there's something better out there. You know, I wanted her to be someone who's like, this is it. I won. This is great. So when it left her, she really felt like she had completely lost everything. And then she sort of found her superpower, mm-hmm. which is comedy and being able to get up on stage and talk about her life and talk about everyone else in her life, whether they want her to or not. And she also discovered a really strong, ambitious streak in her that has sort of taken over everything as sort of her new guiding light. So and she wears really cute dresses.
She wears
like
great.
Such cute dresses.
Great.
So really tiny waist, and she wears hats, and it's adorable. And
Rachel Brosnahan was pretty unknown to most people, not a household name when she took the role. What is it about her, you think, that she gets about this part?
When she first, you know, it's unusual. A lot of people in our business, in the comedy business, are kind of like, well, if it's someone playing stand-up comic, it should either be a stand-up comic or obviously someone who's done comedy. And Rachel had done, I think, almost pretty much no comedy.
Yeah, I think Rachel's entire career was her being kidnapped and thrown in ditches and, you know, and a lot of crying.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And to Amazon's credit, a lot of companies would ding an actress like this and just say, we don't want to experiment with somebody trying to act funny. But to us, we were really intrigued. And I think what she came in was, again, it's the confidence word. Midge is very confident. Rachel is very confident. So that really helps. Like she was holding her sides and her hands were not shaking. And a lot of actresses' hands shake. It was a big part to audition for, and we gave them three big scenes to do. So I think the confidence, and I think the sort of, she also kind of got the underlying anger that is in every comedian. And she sort of innately got that. And she's just this incredible actress who pulled off the stunt of being a realistic stand-up comic, going through all the phases of learning it. It was a really tough thing to do. And I think just the confidence is what really sold it.
And to Midge's confidence, that confidence doesn't always make her 100% likable.
Mm-hmm. No, and we weren't actually interested in that because we had come from, you know, you spend years on network television where they're like, oh, she can't raise her voice. That's not likable. Or, oh, make sure she doesn't wear red. Red is not likable. And like, oh, the hair, make sure the hair is really likable. You know, so like the last thing in the world I ever want to hear again in my entire life is the female character likable? It's just, is she interesting? Is she viable? Is her journey something that people want to watch? And the great thing about, again, Rachel Brosnahan, who is kind of just a steamroller through life, she wasn't interested in being likable. She was interested in playing somebody very interesting and very different from what she had played before. And we got lucky that, because you don't want to have to spend half your time talking your actress into, it doesn't matter if you're likable. Mm-hmm. It's okay if you raise your voice. It doesn't matter. You're a human being. Sometimes human beings aren't likable. 90% of them are never likable. You know, at least you're going to be likable like 50, 60% of the time. That's not bad by human standards. So
yeah, and men have been pulling it off in TV for many, many years. Al from Deadwood, everyone loved him. Tony Soprano, everyone loved him. Walter White, everyone loved him. If you hated those guys personally, you would not watch the show, even though they were often despicable. There's been an obvious double standard for women characters in movies and TV, and so we wanted to make sure that you saw the foibles of this character too, that you saw that she was human and sometimes very, very selfish and sometimes very, very self-centered and maybe not the best mother all the time, as, you know, mothering standards were so different back then. We wanted to reflect that you didn't hover over your child and you didn't necessarily tell your child you loved them every day and every hour. So we're trying to do what men have gotten away with for a long time.
Ambition in women is something that I think a lot of times people think is an unattractive trait. And yet in men, ambition is how you get what you want in life.
You said something so interesting in your answer about actresses being concerned about their perception of not being likable, even though they're playing a part. Is that really an issue for young actresses that you've run into?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, part of what's interesting that I found, because I tend to write characters who at some point are going to yell. Just at some point, usually in the pilot, they're going to yell at somebody. And I have found that it's a hard thing for a lot of actresses to do because they are so aware of the fact that behind the scenes, a lot of times they are judged on how feminine you are and how likable you are, and raising your voice and yelling is not considered a likable trait in a woman. And a lot of times you have to really tell actresses, like, you gotta yell.
Yeah, it's okay.
You're pissed. Mm-hmm. You gotta yell. Mm-hmm. Your husband left you. If there's any time when you can yell, perhaps this is the time. So it is a thing, and hopefully the more that parts are being written for actresses that aren't being decided on the level of likability, but more on the level like, what is the journey? How interesting is this person? Do they have a story to tell? Maybe actresses in the future will not be coming to the table with that sort of baggage on them. But it is an issue, and not for Rachel.
Rachel's good.
Rachel doesn't care. Rachel's like, I'll just go out there and, you want me to kill a kitten? I'll do it. That's fine. I'm good.
My guests are Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. One of the things I think is interesting about the show, there are many interesting things, but I like the sort of anthropological sort of excavation of New York City and this particular family at this time. There are a lot of details about this affluent Jewish family on the Upper West Side, down to like where the dad works and how they keep the house. What was it about this time period that you thought was really ripe? And if you could share a couple of details that you put in the script and in the family composition to let us know more about this family at this time.
Well, the time period was really picked because comedy was starting to shift a little bit and starting to become a little bit more talking about real things and life and politics and family and sexuality, and it hadn't been before. Comedy had been a little bit more like, take my wife, please. Mm-hmm. You know, so we felt like that time period would be an interesting time to throw someone who's just starting a career in comedy, because it's straddling that old school, new school world, and especially a woman where there just weren't a lot of women in comedy. It's tough for a woman in comedy now, but back then it was a nightmare. And to put somebody who is finding her voice, so actually talking about things is going to be important to her, and not pretending to be a character or a you know, quaint or ugly, you know, not putting a weird boa on her, you know, and talking with a voice, you know, like that she's actually going to go and talk about being young, being possibly divorced, possibly what does she do now? Children, should she have been a mother? She never thought about it before. That these are things that she wants to be able to talk about on stage. That time period felt right for that.
Yeah, and as far as the family and the whole setting, you know, we always kept in mind that, like, this is a generation and a time when World War II, like, almost all the young men walking around were World War II veterans. When Zach Levi came on last year and played the Dr. Benjamin, I don't know if we mentioned it, but we told him he is a World War II veteran. So it was. So we always kept that in mind. And of course, for a Jewish family, we always keep in mind that the Holocaust was 15 years before. And that also, not only was it the heartbreak of that era and of what happened, but also this is a Jewish family now that is prosperous, feeling safe, feeling affluent, and is really becoming a part of, a natural part of the American fabric. So that's something that we always kind of keep in mind too. And of course, Midge kind of blows it up with because of what happened to her, she decides to take a path that this family was not expecting, that this family did not want. So everything's kind of shaken up, but it is a family that was just sort of becoming like the true American family back then.
My guests are Amy Sherman Palladino and Dan Palladino. I heard you say it earlier when I was watching a roundtable interview that you were on of writers, just your joy of not being at a network.
Oh my God.
Let's put it in the positive, shall we?
Hallelujah.
So for civilians.
Yes.
Let's say you were doing this show for a major network. Think about a scene or something that you wanted to do that, and how that would have gone at the network.
Well, this show could not have been done at the network.
Period.
No, they would never have, in a gazillion years, they all would have said, oh my God, we want to do that show. And that would be the end of it. They may have even gone so far as to pick up a pilot. And then you try to cast it, and that would have been the end of it. I mean, it's.
And then they would damn you, like, if when they call you to tell you that your project's not going forward, the first thing they say to people like us is, "I love the writing. I love the writing is so amazing." And Amy and I look at each other like,
"Oh, we're
dead.
We are
sunk.
we've just been canceled. It's all over."
You know, we're still schmucks with Underwoods, but. It's really like there's a lot of reasons why this character went, you know, because you see this character and you think, oh, she's so sweet, she's so likable, and her journey is interesting to me. But they would not like a lot of aspects of it. They would not like her ambition. And I'm saying traditionally, you know, the networks. I don't know who's at the networks now, because we haven't worked at a network in ages.
And we never will again.
But we came up in a system where basically. We're not going to tell you exactly how old we are.
130,000.
We're the same vintage.
It's something like that. Yeah, but we came up at a time when basically there were like four networks, and it was an extremely conservative business. And we're not just talking about now we can say curse words on TV, which has positives, but you don't have to. All in the Family was a great show. It was on a network. They never said a curse word. They said certain words that we don't say anymore. But there have been great network comedies, great network shows, but generally
not in a long time though.
Because, not in a long,
you know,
long time.
The thing about the networks that people need to understand is networks are run by the marketing department. And that is the basic difference. When the marketing department, the people who have to sell soap, are making creative decisions, and that is the bottom line, then you're screwed, because they only care about the demographics that's going to buy the Tide or buy the car or buy this. And your piece has to conform to that. There is no interest in conforming what they do to your piece. Also, they have changed the structure of television so much. When, you know, back in the old days, you know, when Dan and I and the dinosaurs roamed the earth and we first started out in sitcom was two acts. It's what, five, six acts now?
Yeah, I mean.
So they keep chopping it up, and they make the actual playing time shorter to put more commercial time in. So your ability to tell any sort of cohesive story goes right out the window, because every time you got an act break that you got to go to commercial, you want to try and keep them and bring them back. So you can't just take a story and then chop it up. There's got to be a dun-dun-dun moment. Yeah.
Bam,
and then,
bam, bam. Commercial.
And then half the time, right, when you come back from the commercial, you have to take back the dun-dun-dun moment because it was a lie. Because you had to put it in, and then you had to sell the soap, and then you got to continue on. And it's exhausting. And it's just not a creative way of thinking about storytelling or character or the process. It's just, it's not gratifying to have nobody in the sphere of power be interested in the actual creative aspect of it, because that's really not what network television is set up to do. They are set up to sell ad time. And when you go to a streaming service, they don't care. Kellogg's is like anyone else. Kellogg's can figure out how to turn on the, and fast forward, and they're just watchers. They have no skin in the game.
Well, I would think they would care more about the quality of the content because they have to entice people to come to it.
It's sort
of like
so
the public radio
to
model.
Go.
Yeah. The public media model. It's the quality.
Yes.
Or even HBO. It's the quality of the content that
it's
makes people.
It's
you
HBO.
Have to take a jump.
Yeah.
Right. Like A Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is not going to have as many viewers as like Hawaii Five-0 at its peak on the network. But I have a feeling they don't share any data with us, and we don't need to know the data. But I have a feeling that like a show like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel probably draws us enough people of a like interest that suit them in some way, and they let us do our thing, and it's really nice to be able to do our thing, and then it's up to us to entertain the audience. Like if people like Amazon let us do our thing, then the responsibility is on us to do our thing well, because the audience is always right. It's not right for us to like write something, produce it, absolutely no one watches. We can't say the audience was wrong. The audience was right. There was something wrong with the project. So we like having that responsibility, and we're happy to have it. And Amazon has dumped a lot of it on us, and we're appreciative of that.
My guests are Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. You have to go to Paris. Second season? Mm-hmm.
Paris.
Miami?
There's nothing like Paris. I mean, shooting in Paris was literally like, if I die right now, that's fine. It's totally okay. Because it was as dreamy as you think it would be. It was just like magic. It was amazing. It was amazing. But yes, we're going to a couple places this year, and she's on tour this year. So we had to take her on tour. And everyone was excited about tour until they saw how much it was going to cost. And then there was like, oh, can she just drive to the Bronx and back? What about that tour? The five borough tour, that's an exciting tour. But it's going to be good. If it doesn't kill us, it'll be great.
And you guys are back in New York. You guys have returned to the city.
Yeah.
Is it easier to write here?
We love writing here. We love the theater community. We love concerts. I mean, New York is the great American city to go out and do things, like the rooftop movies in the summer and ballet and theater and film forum. And it just goes on and on and on. We love, we imbibe a lot of culture and we love it. And there's
and
no
we grew
place
up in
like
the San Fernando Valley, which is basically, a Ralph store and you're out.
Once it's they close the drive-in, man,
like
it was
Ralph's
all over.
I spent my entire life knowing I did not belong on the West Coast. That from the time I was literally old enough to realize, the sun and the thing and the, ugh. So the minute that we could extricate ourselves from LA and move out to New York, we packed up the books and we left. And that's it.
It's a lot of books.
That's it. We're here. We're never leaving.
Don't trust people who don't have books.
No,
you
never,
can't. No,
never.
It's ridiculous.
My guests have been Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. Thanks for coming to the studio, you guys.
You are
no,
so thanks welcome.
For us.
Stay with us. This is All of It. We'll have more after the break.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.